bienvenido. Asimismo, saludamos a quienes participan aquí en el Flamengo, como decíamos a Steven, nuestra máxima aula, ¿sí? El lugar más bello de la Universidad de Guadalajara, para mí. Asimismo, saludamos a quienes participan a distancia, ¿sí? Ya sea a través del sistema de videoconferencia, a través de internet, nuestros estudiantes que están por diferentes lugares de México y del mundo. Steven, muchas gracias por compartir conocimientos generales tanto en el programa del Sistema de Apoyo al Aprendizaje del Consejo Nacional de Investigación en Canadá, como lo aprendido de tus experiencias con personas de diferentes lugares del mundo y lo generado por tus experiencias. La lectura de los aspectos de Steven Down, más allá de lo que dicen, son interesantes por lo que nos hacen decir. Al reflexionar, por ejemplo, me hace pensar en creer. Al conseguir los repositorios de recursos educativos, no ha sentido de la educación bancaria como un simple depósito de datos e informaciones, sino como una red viva de interacciones educativas. Cuando se habla de centrar los procesos formativos en las personas, en los modos de aprender y de ser, entre los aspectos del aprendizaje más importantes a aprender antes y más allá de las tecnologías, debieran ser entender cómo aprendemos, saber cómo mejorar los modos de aprender, hacer los aprendizajes de mayor importancia y trascendencia en relación con las aportaciones del colectivismo y en especial a lo aportado por Steven, debe retomarse el reconocimiento a la diversidad, el enfoque a la conexión y comunicación permanente entre campos de conocimiento, palabras, la palabra como objeto de aprendizaje, ideas, conceptos, comunidades de aprendizaje y sobre todo las personas y sus proyectos de vida. Que la creación de recursos educativos parte de la palabra misma y no son la exclusiva de los profesionales de la docencia, siendo su principal origen y más significativo cuando los estudiantes crean sus propios objetos de aprendizaje, sus propios recursos educativos. Eso significa que la educación institucional en cualquiera de sus modalidades y más allá de las modalidades, creo que cada vez hemos estado aprendiendo cada vez más es que no debiera haber ya barreras entre modalidades educativas y que debe ocuparse más en los procesos educativos esenciales y no tanto las circunstancias de tiempo, o sea, en qué horario o calendario sucede, no tanto las situaciones de espacio, no en qué aula o qué número de qué lugar sucede, como suele ser la programación académica tradicional, superar los formatos masivos homogeneizantes y en serie de los modos de aprender, enseñar y evaluar, más propios de la producción industrial del siglo XVIII y de la educación a distancia tradicional, mejor dar lugar a la diversidad de los modos de ser, aprender y diversidad de los modos de manifestar lo aprendido, más apropiados a la sociedad de conocimiento a la que decimos aspirar. Que no debemos esperar a que las condiciones sean propicias para esos cambios. Si así fuera, las innovaciones no serían necesarias. Que no es un dilema tener que decidir entre lo individual o lo general, entre lo local o lo global, lo común o lo diferente, sino buscar opciones donde se conjunte lo personal y colectivo, alternativas que encontramos en la obra de Stephen Down. El diseño de gestión curricular, limitar las fuentes de información predeterminadas y rígidas en sus circunstancias y modos, resultan más que obsoletos, son estorbos en un entorno sociotecnológico favorable al acceso libre y directo a los conocimientos en constante generación. Distinto, lo hasta ahora compartido y construido en los diálogos y el taller de esta semana, así como esta conferencia, sin duda, nos ayudarán a mejorar los procesos de aprendizaje en nuestra universidad, especialmente motivarnos a superar las limitaciones de la formación árbitra tradicional y decir, como dice la última obra de la UNESCO, atrevernos a reinventar y replantear la educación. Muchas gracias.
A continuación, escucharemos la intervención del doctor Miguel Ángel Navarro Navarro, vicepresidente ejecutivo de nuestra alma.
Distinguidos miembros del presidio, estimado público que nos acompaña de manera presencial y a través de los medios y los sistemas. En nombre del rector, el maestro Rodrigo Bravo, rector de esta universidad, les ofrezco una disculpa en sus nombres, se encuentra en la Ciudad de México, atendiendo asuntos inherentes a su cargo. Está en este momento peleándose con el secretario de Hacienda, y yo creo que es muy importante que usted por ahí, para evitar que nos reduzcan como amenaza el presupuesto universitario. Pero esto me permite a mí tener el gusto de saludarlos muy cordialmente y de manera especial, junto con el maestro Manuel Moreno, como ya lo dijo, darle la más calurosa bienvenida a nuestro congresista magistral, el doctor Silvio Linares, que el día de hoy nos presentará la conferencia sobre tres y mayor aprendizaje personal. Para la Universidad de Guadalajara representa un honor contar con la participación de conferencistas de talla internacional como el que hoy nos acompaña en este esplendoroso recinto universitario. Desde que recibí la notificación del rector, yo le daría su mensaje. Despertó mi interés en recorrer algunos viejos tiempos en el campus universitario de Los Valles, cuando discutíamos estas innovaciones en la forma de hacer la educación. Yo recuerdo que hace algunos años, expertos en educación vaticinaron el crecimiento exponencial de la educación de niños, con la consecuente disminución del aprendizaje presencial. Había incluso quien recomendaba más inversión en redes, nodos, conexiones, computadoras, programas, software y demás herramientas tecnológicas, a la par que se recomendaba la paulatina disminución de la inversión en aulas y en instalaciones físicas. Más tecnología, menos padrinos, se llegó a decir, en algunos lugares. No obstante, en sociedades como la nuestra, pues esto no ha ocurrido a la velocidad que se vaticinaba y los avances han sido mucho más lentos que los esperados. La pregunta es si esto va a ser así, o tiene que ser así. Es cuestión cultural. Tiene que ver con escasez de recursos, porque la apariencia de la tecnología es muy costosa. O quizás sea que es necesario un cambio de generación y que muchos de los que estudian hoy educación primaria, cuando lleguen a la universidad, necesitan más aprendizaje a través de medios virtuales y menos aprendizaje presencial. ¿Será que como generación tenemos que ir diciendo adiós? O quizás, no me atrevo a enmarcar los conceptos de interrogación, muchos tengan que ver la común y frecuente ineficiencia de nuestras autoridades, a veces federales, a veces locales, gubernamentales, que en lo general suelen ser cortovenidas. Como muestra, pues tenemos muchos botones. Estamos ya inmersos, dicen nuestras autoridades, en una supuesta reforma educativa de la educación básica que lleva como por lo menos 30 años de retraso y que está lejos de que podamos superar. Estamos discutiendo sobre la conveniencia de evaluar a los profesores, siendo que la mayoría de los países la evaluación es algo natural, algo normal, es como cumplir con un requisito mínimo, pero vaya que está suscitado por pruebas y revoluciones por algo que es muy común. Es el sentido común que todos tengamos que evaluarnos para comprobar que también estamos haciendo lo que hacemos. Como se podría contratar un piloto sin una mínima prueba que demuestre que es capaz de conducir un avión, pero al menos de aterrizar, parece que es lo más difícil. Es la innovación educativa y el uso de las nuevas tecnologías y el aprendizaje en línea, del cambio de rol del profesor y del estudiante en el aula, de todo esto y más, seguro la decisión tendrá que esperar algunos años, cuando finalmente todos aceptemos ser evaluados, no solo los profesores, todos los actores sociales, todas las autoridades universitarias, gubernamentales, para saber si lo que estamos haciendo bien es posible, si lo estamos haciendo bien. Creo que ahí tenemos parte de la respuesta a la pregunta de por qué en México la innovación educativa no es una tarea pendiente y que está en espera de requerimientos más favorables a nuestro arco educativo. Hoy el tema que abordará el doctor Downs es muy interesante y de mucha actualidad, sobre todo para el mundo de la misma educación, para la universidad virtual que promueve este tipo de eventos, a quienes reconozco su labor en la organización de particular al maestro Manuel, a su equipo, por haber traído a tan distinguido comprensión. Y sin más, preámbulo en nombre del maestro Donato Grau, le agradezco al doctor Stephen Downs aceptar venir a compartir sus conocimientos y sus experiencias y desearle que su estancia en nuestra universidad, en nuestra ciudad, sea reconfortante y satisfactoria. No solo conocimiento, mucho mariachi, mucho tequila. Bienvenido, muchas gracias.
Invitados a las novedades que nos acompañaron en esta jornada, a los lugares que tienen la vida y este auditorio, para dar principio con nuestra conferencia magistral sobre el país de la gente impartida por el siete americanos.
Muchas gracias. Ya me tengo que retirar.
Para presentar a nuestro conferencista de la mayoría y moderar los trabajos de esta conferencia, quiero darle la palabra a la doctora Margarita Chávez Núñez, jefa del Instituto de Gestión y Conocimiento en Ambientes Virtuales.
Bien. Es un privilegio para mí compartir este día, este espacio con Stephen Downs, para todos nosotros muy conocido por distintos motivos. He de resaltar algunas de las cuestiones que a lo mejor no todos sepamos, algunos a lo mejor nos hemos asociado más a su línea de trabajo por alguna de las tantas cosas que ha venido haciendo. Yo quisiera destacar que sin duda es uno de los personajes que en el campo de la investigación sobre educación mediada por tecnologías, de formación y comunicación, sin duda está colocando los principales temas en los que estamos debatiendo quienes nos dedicamos a esto. Y por eso es muy significativo el poder tenerlo tan cerca, tan accesible, porque como buen sabio que es una persona sencilla y siempre dispuesto a compartir, ¿no?, todo el conocimiento que ha venido produciendo. Él conduce el programa de sistemas de apoyo de aprendizaje y crecimiento del Consejo Nacional de Investigación de Canadá. Y esa responsabilidad, ese tamaño de responsabilidad, ha sido o ha llegado a ella a partir de un largo camino de esfuerzo en el que todos nosotros seguramente hemos venido conociendo en algún momento de su trabajo los tópicos que se han colocado en tendencia. Por ejemplo, él estuvo totalmente ligado a lo que es el desarrollo del concepto de objeto de aprendizaje, ¿no? En su momento también, por supuesto, la significación de recursos digitales para el aprendizaje. Y tal vez de las cosas que más se han difundido en los últimos años ha tenido que ver con toda esta, el impulso a lo que son los cursos masivos y abiertos en línea, que desde la filosofía que han impulsado son estos cursos de carácter conectivista, que de pronto incluso se han venido disociando de los otros cursos que se han quedado más en la memoria y que son los que más se han estado trabajando, los MOOCs a través de algunas otras organizaciones. Pero él ha insistido en su perspectiva y así fue como llegamos a sus trabajos y a conocerlo de manera más profunda. Creo yo que entre las cosas que hay que resaltar es sobre todo toda esta tendencia de la cual nos va a hablar en su conferencia del día de hoy, que tiene que ver con la personalización en el aprendizaje y que a veces puede parecer como en una paradoja cuando estamos hablando de masividad y de colaboración, pero yo creo que justo por eso es tan importante escucharlo, justo tan es tan importante tener justamente al que ha colocado estos temas y al conectivismo siendo creador del concepto junto con John Simmons, pero con todo el desarrollo que ha venido haciendo con su equipo, no es nada menor que podamos tener de su voz estos planteamientos que ya ven aquí con nosotros. Sin más, bueno, y agradeciendo mucho su presencia, su generosidad con nosotros, lo dejo para que nos hable de estas tendencias. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Dr. Emanuel, for inviting me here. Yes, turn on the slide. Oh, Tifa. And now they've set the sound just right. Thank you for the very kind welcome here at the university. I've enjoyed several days meeting with your students and engaging in the workshop we had yesterday, which was a pleasure for me and helped me learn a little more Spanish. And the welcome I've received here in Guadalajara is one where I can go back home and say that you have literally given me the clothing off your backs, and I appreciate the hospitality and the goodwill that you've shown me that in the time that I've been here. I want to talk about personal learning. The overall talk is called Toward Personal Learning, which I forgot when I made this slide, but that's okay, it's still the same talk. What I want to talk about is some of the motivation that we have leading us toward not just online learning in general, but personal learning in particular. I want to talk about some of the design foundations, the theory that we are employing, and then talk about the specific works that we are doing creating a personal learning environment at the National Research Council of Canada. My role with the National Research Council is to lead a program of research projects called Learning and Performance Support Systems, and I'll be talking about that in some detail in this talk. You know, we're at a time, not just in Canada, not just in Mexico, but around the world, where we're facing unprecedented challenges and opportunities. Dr. Navarro referred to the issues of funding, he referred to the issues of technology investment and the pace of change in our institutions. And these are challenges that we see in Canada as well. These are challenges that we have seen, that I have seen, as I visited with different countries around the world. So rest assured, they're not unique to your country. For institutions, we're looking at changing business models. We looked at the history of the music industry and the publishing industry, how long-time companies have been dissolved or absorbed by other companies. We looked at the publishing industry, where cities used to have two newspapers, now they have one newspaper, many cities have zero newspapers, and looked at the way technologies like Uber and Airbnb are changing fundamental businesses that we thought would never change, like the taxi service or hotels. And institutions are designed, like the university is designed, to work from the center, to have a centralized campus where everybody comes to the university and the university provides a service for people. But this is becoming more and more difficult as people have different needs, as the environment changes, and standard things that we have used in the past, like curricula and standardized tests, are going the way of, well, we don't know what will follow. But we know that standard curricula and standardized tests are not meeting the need that we have for an agile and adaptive form of learning. For government and society, education has never been a bigger challenge. In Canada, as well as in Mexico, and in many other countries I've visited around the world, in Europe and in Asia and in Africa, there are skill shortages. We cannot get qualified people to do the essential work that needs to be done to make a society run. Canadian oil and gas, for example, loses billions of dollars every year because they cannot hire people to do the work that they need. In Canada, the unemployment rate for skilled and professional workers is less than 1%. We cannot, even in Canada, find enough skilled and professional people to manage our industries and our technologies. And training is time-consuming, it's expensive. And for the individual learner, which really has always been the focus of my work, access to learning still remains difficult. Even in places like Canada, the United States, Europe, it's still difficult to stop everything you are doing and go to college or university. In many countries, including my own, the cost of tuition is too high. The cost of textbooks is too high. It costs $180 for a single book. I can't even afford that, and I have a job. Learning and development needs to continue after graduation, but the universities are not designed to support this. And even when you have an education, it is difficult to find employment, difficult to match your skills to the opportunities that are out there. So, at the National Research Council, we have designed an approach to address these challenges to institutions, to government and society, to individuals, that we call learning and performance support systems. And the idea here, the fundamental core of the idea, is to provide a single point of access to all your education and development needs. But it's something very different from the idea of a university portal or Amazon.com or something like that. It's supposed to be something that's personal, that you carry with you, like your wallet. But like your wallet, it's connected to other things, the Department of Motor Vehicles, your bank, your credit card, your health care insurance. It has different kinds of things, not just courses. A course is a very specific educational intervention for a very specific purpose. But we are finding that we need many different types of services and resources available to support a learning environment. Everything from communications to resources to credentials, permits, licenses, and more. And so it is our objective to create this single point of access. Why us? Why Canada's National Research Agency? There's two major reasons why we've chosen to take on this task. The first is that we have deep experience and deep technology that allows us to make some of the investments that a company or an educational institution might not be able to make. We have the good fortune of being supported by our federal government. and supported by different parties over different years. The National Research Council is more than 75 years old. We have a history of developing science and technology. And we are deeply connected to online learning and e-learning. We have a history of works in foundational technologies like learning management systems and learning objects and repository networks. And we have very good connections with colleges, universities around the world, and with companies and industries involved in education. Some of the works that we've done in the past, we built something called the EduSource Resource Repository Network. It was a pan-Canadian network of learning object repositories linking businesses and universities across the country. We built something called Sifter Filter, which was a content recommendation service, which was later commercialized under the name Rakofi. Terrible name. We created something called Share. What Share does is look at content like Facebook posts or tweets or news articles and extracts the sentiment or the feeling behind the post. So it's a type of analytics. In cooperation with Desire to Learn, the learning management company, we built a collaborative workflow and content development system called Synergique. And my own work has involved Grasshopper, which is a personal content creation and aggregation tool, and of course, the work that we've done in massive open online courses and connectivism. Most people know me today because of the MOOCs. I'm really sorry about the name. I did not name it. But the name means something. Massive. Not massive simply because we have a lot of people, but massive because the design of the system allows us to be massive. Open. Not just free, but also free to use. Not just free of cost, but free to share. Free to attend. Free to change and adapt. Online. So that anybody can access it, not just the people in your town or at your university. And courses. Not communities, not video collections like YouTube, but courses that have a beginning, have an end, and are organized around a topic. So that was the core idea of the MOOC. Our course design looked very different from a traditional course design. What you're seeing here is a map of one of our courses that was drawn by one of the participants in the course, because we're not that good artists. And it does not look like a traditional course, does it? But this is what George Siemens and I built in 2008, and we designed it to be like a network, many different resources connected to each other. So there's no single path through resources, and indeed there's no single focus around which everybody must collect. It's distributed, it's peer-to-peer, and it's based on communication rather than content. And another thing that we did, which was very important, is that we did not see the MOOC as a place everybody had to come to. We saw our MOOC as just one piece of a wider network of people and services. And we told people, if you would like to participate in our MOOCs, you may use Blogger, you may use WordPress, you may use Flickr, you may use Google Groups, you may use Second Life. And people did. And that's what made it great. We had people who took our course who never actually attended our website. They followed the course completely outside of the course. And that's the way it should be. This is CCK08. It stands for Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. 2008. It was the first course that George Siemens and I designed. We designed it as an exercise to illustrate the theory of connectivism, which the two of us had been working on since 2004. It's a difficult theory. It's hard to grasp. I'll talk a little bit about it today, but I won't cover all of it. And we found that it was impossible to just tell people about the theory. So we decided to show people about the theory, show them what it looks like in practice. So we built this course. We built it like a network, because that's what the theory says, that learning is a phenomenon that happens in networks. And we expected 20, 25 people, and we got 2,200 people. A normal course would have been swamped. It would have been impossible. The opening thread would have taken the entire year to read. Hello, my name is, for 2,200 people. But because the design was distributed, because we built it as a network, we were easily able to adapt to 2,200 people. We offered other courses in the same model. In 2010, George and I offered a course called Personal Learning Environments, Networks, and Knowledge, PLANK, another name that I have to apologize for. With EduCause and the Gates Foundation, we built a course, a 30-week-long course called CHANGE. 30 weeks, 35 weeks, 36 weeks. We discovered in that course, 36 weeks is too long for a course. Since then, there have been other people creating other MOOCs. We have now heard of, for example, the Stanford Artificial Intelligence MOOC, companies like Coursera, Udacity, founded by Sebastian Krun, edX, and others. And what has happened over time is that they took this original concept and they brought it back to the traditional university model with the centralized classroom and the instructor who was in charge of everything. And their courses were based on content and the presentation of videos. Really a very traditional sort of course. And much of what you are reading about MOOCs in the popular press and also in journal articles addresses these content-based MOOCs. When people talk about low completion rates, for example, they're talking about people who start these courses. In the connectivism course, we had 1,800 people sign up for the newsletter at the beginning of the course, and at the end of the course we had 1,800 people still subscribed to the newsletter, although it was a very easy thing to drop out. There's a range now of MOOCs, of different types of MOOCs. On the one hand, on that side of the slide, are courses like George and I built that are based on networks, on webs, that are distributed, that are not based on content, but are based on interaction and communication. On the other side are those courses called XMOOCs, after EdX and TEDx and other things like that, that are based around content, hero professors, and very large audiences who do not interact, all they do is listen. And in the middle is a very interesting type of hybrid course, such as Jim Groom's DS106 course, which is not as distributed as ours, but still distributed, and which is based on doing tasks or completing objectives. Well, that's a model that interests me a lot. These are the four major design principles we employed when we built our networks that became MOOCs. These design principles are based on network theory. They're based on graph theory. And they represent the principles that enable a network to function at its maximum efficiency. If we think about a network as a collection, say, of people, a network is not efficient when nobody is connected, because nobody's talking to anyone else. It is not efficient when everybody is connected, because then you hear nothing but noise. So you need a design or a structure of a network that allows for interactivity, but it allows for interactivity that is somewhere in between nothing and everything. And then there are shapes and structures of that network that maximize the potential of that communication. And these shapes and structures are described by these four principles. Autonomy. Each entity in the network makes its own decisions, works according to its own values, has its own individual objectives. Diversity. Many different types of people or things or whatever are connected to each other. People can use different devices, people can speak different languages, people can want to do different things. Openness. Openness to allow everybody to join and become a part of the network. As the network grows, it becomes more effective. And openness in the sense that the content created by the network is shared with other people in the network and everybody else in the world. And interactivity. The idea that knowledge is created not by one person on a stage broadcasting, but rather by all of us together interacting with each other and producing something that none of us had at the beginning of the day. In technical terms, we call that emergent knowledge. The pedagogy of the MOOC describes how you, as an individual person, a node in the network, works in this environment. And it's interesting, I look at many different theories and many different descriptions of the educational process in an online world, and they're very similar to this. And there are four stages: to aggregate or bring things together, to remix or join them with each other from different sources, to repurpose or shape what you've created to your own language, to your own need, to your own community, and then to feed forward, to share what you have created with other people, so that what you've done in your learning can help benefit the entire community. All four of these things are necessary. One of them by itself does not provide the effective instructional and educational environment of a MOOC. You need to do all four. So, we transition in this way from the design and the pedagogy of the MOOC to the design and the pedagogy of personal learning. We ask, what is it like for a single person, you or you, to live and work in a massive open online course? And we get the picture of people we can see here. I'm pointing to something you can't see. But people you can see here that are circled in red who might be connected with each other, and people that are connected with services, resources, teachers, mentors, students, the general public, whomever. If we look at what is happening behind the scenes in a massive open online course, we see a type of pedagogy that describes a mechanism whereby students help each other. So here's a simple four-stage process. The first student creates something. Maybe they're reviewing a movie, maybe they're describing a plant that they've seen, maybe they're summarizing an event that they've taken part in, like this talk. And they make that resource available to the site, available to the course. A second student in the course sees that resource, the listing for that resource, and says to him or herself, this is something that might be useful to me. And then they access the resource directly. Notice they do not come back to the course. They don't have to. They just go right to the other student's website. Now we've left the course. And now the web of communications can do its work. And the other person looks at the first person's resource, thinks about it, thinks it's really useful, and creates a link, and a third person can see it, and a fourth person, and so on. And if the resource is of value, it, as we say, cascades through the network, being shared by more and more people. From the course provider perspective, now this is the institutional perspective, this is the view of colleges and universities, it looks like this diagram, where the site, which is created by the institution, like the MOOCs that George and I created, or like a course website that the University of Guadalajara may create, that site is connected by student content. You see that there in the upper right? I can't tell. Your left, my right. So WordPress, YouTube, etc. That's the content that they've created. In the upper left are the people themselves. In the lower, oh, this is still terrible. I am very educated on things, but when I was a young child, I failed left and right. So there is also the course content. There are live online events like this event here, and these may be recorded. I'm recording this event. I have my computer here, and I have my nice microphone here, and I capture this audio. I see that you've got a video recording going up there. And the idea here is not simply to record, but now we're creating a new learning resource through participation and interaction. And now this resource goes back to the site, and it's shared, and it becomes something that becomes part of the wider community. From the student's perspective, which is what we'll be looking at in more detail, the student is connected to other people. The student is connected to the course, but that's just one thing in an environment of many things. And through the other students and through the course, the student is connected to an entire world of resources related to whatever it is the course is about. So if I am studying physics, I am connected to other people who study physics, and I am talking to them, with them, about physics. And together, we find a wide range of resources around the internet about physics. And we access the resources or the telephone call from friends about physics, because I know that call is about this talk. And we create resources, labs, experiments, whatever, and share them, and that becomes part of this wider collection of resources around the internet. From the student's perspective, the student is at the center and is connected all around by the different resources. See, all the cameras are gone, so I can wave my hands. The design is a design that has been in the community for a number of years ago. for a number of years now. The one document on your left that has future VLE in the center is a diagram that was created by Scott Wilson to describe the concept of the personal learning environment. And as you can see, the student is at the center, the resources are around the edge. Another diagram by Tim Hand talks about different applications and services. So again, the student is at the center, the applications and the services are around the outside. We always think of the student being at the center and then many other things being connected to them. And that's the core of what we are doing with the Learning and Performance Support System. Our technology is built around what we call the personal learning record. And the personal learning record is a new type of data. It's not 100% new, but it's pretty new. We call it the personal graph. The personal graph is a very large database file that is a representation of all of your work, all of your resources, all of your friends in the form of a graph. And when I say in the form of a graph, what I mean is that it looks like a giant network. Your personal graph is designed the same way as our Connectivist course, but it includes everything you do. The idea of the personal graph is this belongs to the student, not to the institution. This follows the student from place to place, from institution to institution, from job to job. It contains their certificates, their badges, their credentials. It contains links to activity records that they may have created while working with simulations or working with tools on a worksite. It contains links to test scores, evaluation results, and their assignments, their papers, their drawings, their videos, anything they create. It is a complete personal learning record, and that's why it must be private and personally owned by the individual student. No other institution can acquire this much data, or if they did, it would be a gross violation of personal privacy. So only the individual student, the individual person, can manage the totality of their knowledge. Just like only I, it's a prop, only I control this, in theory. Nobody else controls this. Right? And I would not want the government to have this. I would not, when I go to a university, I do not say, here, take my credit cards, right? And that's the idea with the personal learning environment. That's the only problem. I need a new wallet, though. So, here's the rest of LPSS built around this personal learning record. And as you can see, it embodies the principles of connective learning that I've been talking about so far. In the upper left, we have access to different resources that were created by other people or by the institution or by publishers or by governments or by companies or whomever. The lower left is your own personal library of books you've saved, things you've created, messages from friends, anything else. Anything that's big goes in the library. Learning activities are things that will support you not only when you're in college or university, but also when you're outside college and university, you want to learn a language, you want to learn how to operate a new machine, you want to learn about elephants. The learning activities help you learn these things. And then connected to all of this are learning analytics, intelligent systems that help create a learning path for you, help show you what you need to do in order to meet your objectives, what competencies you need to acquire in order to reach a job or an employment position. A set of analytics that looks at the information and the activities around you and shapes them and tailors them to you, your experience, the context you find yourself in, the job you are doing, and the objectives you have. It's a hard thing to build. Trust me. Here's a simplified description of the sort of architecture that I'm talking about. So on the left-hand side, we have what we call the resource repository network, which is the set of connections to all the resources that are out there in the world. The personal cloud on the lower left is your personal library. In the middle is your personal learning record containing your personal graph. On the upper right are the applications that are connected to the personal learning assistant, and on the lower right are things like the automated assessment tools, which work on information that is available from multiple individuals or multiple students. So we've designed our program, and you know, I'm talking right now about our program, but I would recommend that when you look at what I'm describing here and then compare it to what is being done in learning technology today, you will see many of these elements in common. Because this is not just our program, this is also the direction that educational technology is moving generally. So we're building the learning services network and marketplace. We're building the recommendations and the analytics tools. We're building the personal learning record for lifetime management of learning and training records, the learning assistant, and, of course, simulations and tools and other things that we can attach to the LPSS system. So this is what the overview of our program looks like. The five boxes in the center, those are the core elements of LPSS, and then we're applying them to what we call implementation projects, or the things that are in orange. Running out of time?
Yes.
Is that a yes? Okay. That's fine. So the program organization looks like this, where we're moving from individual projects to actual value propositions, concrete products that we're trying to create. And the program outline looks like this, where the one program is broken down into many different projects, many different deliverables and outcomes. Oops, oh, I didn't mean to do that. Oh, I didn't mean to do that either. Oh. I'm sorry. Oh. Whee! So, unfortunately, I can't make this do exactly what I want it to do. So, I want to emphasize for a moment about why this is really difficult. And it's difficult because it's not one big thing that we're building. It's many small things across the network. So things that are really simple in big systems like data storage or authentication or analytics become much more difficult because instead of doing them in one place, we have to do them in a thousand places at a time. So these are the different sections of the program. And what I'm going to do is encourage you to access these slides after the presentation and look at these descriptions. Each one of these has to have specific characteristics and specific features. Protocols for communications with the others. Protocols for the storage of data. We're trying to use systems and methods that are common in the e-learning industry. Learning technologies, interoperability, for example, or experience API. We're connecting our work to simulators. This is a neurotouch simulator that we have, which allows a person to practice brain surgery, and then it takes the activity records of that and stores them in your personal learning record so that if you do a different simulation on a different machine at a different time, this information is available to that simulation. Competency recognition and development, which will, in my view, change how we think about recognizing learning and how we evaluate whether a person has mastered a competency. We believe that we can do this in an automated way by seeing whether the network of people who are already competent in something recognize you, the individual, as being competent as well. The personal learning record, the beating heart of the system, the data that is owned and shared only with your permission, containing everything there is to know about personal learning. About your own personal learning. There are other personal learning record projects out there in the world now. These are some of them. And we will be collaborating with them and connecting with them. And we're moving in our program from the concepts that I've described to actual implementation, to projects with real partners in real communities with real challenges. And we're doing this over a 5-year period that ends in 2018. We've launched a prototype of LPSS at the URL you see there, lpss.me. It's very simple. It does not do a whole lot yet. And we are launching implementation projects designed to improve not only a person's individual learning, but in what we call the double loop. We use the results of the individual learning combined to improve the effectiveness of the learning tools and the learning designs themselves. And we can do this because we are creating analytics not just from one tool, but multiple tools that a person uses. We're expanding LPSS by working with partners and working with funders. We've invested $20 million in this technology initiative, and we are looking for partners both in institutions and in foundations or corporations or governments to contribute and work with us. And we're looking at projects that include open education resources and repositories. We're looking at projects that include badges and credentials and recognition. We're continuing to build our simulation system and extend that into new areas. It currently works in medical and in oil field areas, and we're looking to expand that. And we have a number of projects that are matching people to opportunities, including one that matches small and medium-sized enterprises to government grants, to corporate requests for proposals, and to other forms of development and partnerships. So that's the learning and performance support system. You can see how it evolved from the ideas behind connectivism, behind the massive open online course, and we're moving from the massive open online course toward personal learning. I thank you very much for your time and your kind attention.
Bien, vamos a dar paso entonces a preguntas y comentarios para poder dialogar con estos andados. Entonces, no sé si han pasado algunas papeletas para quienes quieran, por favor, pasarlas a través de la cámara.
questions?
Están recolectando los papeles.
Oh, they're being collected. Oh, I see.
Ahora las veo.
So the questions are being collected.
Sí, creo que vienen en camino. Bueno, igual, como comentaba yo al inicio de la conferencia, yo creo que muchos de los puntos que ha expuesto Stephen Downs tienen que ver con debates que estamos teniendo continuamente en nuestras áreas. Gracias. Bueno, leo una primera de Paola Mercado, que es coordinadora de la Licenciatura en Tecnologías de Información. ¿Cómo diferenciamos el conectivismo del construccionismo?
Okay, so that's a good question. The translator said constructionism. I believe that the question was intended to say constructivism. It's just a small point, but an important one. So the major difference between connectivism and constructivism is in how we imagine knowledge to be created, to be shaped, and to be formed. And then these differences inform differences in our pedagogy. Constructivism, as the name implies, is based on the idea of constructing knowledge. Underlying the construction of knowledge is an understanding of knowledge as a form of representation. And what we are building are models or representations of the world. And these models or representations stand in a semantic relationship to objects in the world or objects in the model. So it's a semantically based understanding of knowledge. Connectivism is based on the changes that happen in a neural network system as a result of perceptual input. Strictly speaking, in connectivism, we say that the knowledge is contained in the connections in the network. We can be a bit more precise and say the knowledge is contained in the strengths of the connections and in the activation values of the individual nodes. But what's important here is that the knowledge is the network itself, and the network itself is not a representation of something else. So connectivism is a non-representational form of knowledge, whereas constructivism is a representational form of knowledge. This is very important because in constructivism, the content matters a lot. Because the content and the truth of the content as it relates to the representation is what we are trying to acquire in learning. And so most constructivist practices are centered around building the content, making meaning, relating it to objects and experiences in the world. In connectivism, we are directly addressing the formation of the network of connections itself, which means instead of acquiring knowledge, we are becoming something that knows. And so creating knowledge in a connectivist perspective is more like exercising your brain. It's more like creating a type of structure of neural net by practice and repetition and experience and feedback. So there are two very different approaches to learning. There's an overlap sometimes in the methodology. Both constructivism and connectivism say communication is very important. But the reason for that, from the different theories, is very different.
Otra pregunta es por qué sí. ¿Por qué se hace énfasis? ¿Por qué se hace énfasis o se pone el foco en la red individual y no en la red colectiva o en el trabajo colaborativo o colectivo que se pudiera hacer juntos?
So why is there an emphasis on the individual network rather than the collaborative network that could be created? I actually addressed this in a series of papers addressing the topic of what I called groups and networks. So, and we need to understand the different types of collective or communities that we can have. And I distinguish them between groups and networks. It's terrible terminology. But on the one hand, we can have a group which is based in ideas like unity, shared meaning, common language, shared objectives, common purpose. On the other hand, we can have what I call a network. We might call this a cooperative association, where the collection of people is formed by the connections between them, the methods of interacting, the common environment they may share. So, in groups or collectives, the emphasis is on everything being the same. And in cooperation, the emphasis is on diversity and interaction. So, the reason why I focus on the individual is when we look at the individual in society, that leads us to look toward a society that is based on cooperation as opposed to collaboration. And the reason why I do that is because a society that is based on cooperation as opposed to collaboration is one that more completely instantiates the fundamental network principles of autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. We find that the more we try to make other people talk and look and act and believe like we do, the less functional society becomes. And it's when we enable individuals to express their own objectives, their own perspectives, to express their lives more fully, that we have a more flourishing, a more dynamic, a more productive, and a more creative society. So that's why I don't emphasize the groups or the collective. Because I think if I use that language, it will lead people to that idea. I want, but society is still very important as long as we understand that society is a network of autonomous individuals, and that the properties, the knowledge, the beliefs, the objectives, the values of a society are not those held by one or another individual in society, but they emerge or result from everybody together interacting in a society. So it's more a way of understanding the type of group rather than not emphasizing the group.
Alma más. ¿Cómo los MOOCs pueden dar soporte a la capacitación de los docentes en lo que se refiere al contenido pedagógico o al conocimiento, ¿no? En la tienda de cine.
So the question asks how MOOCs can support teacher training when it comes especially toward pedagogic knowledge. And I've addressed this question in the past by asking teachers, especially experienced teachers, how do you learn? Not how did you learn, because I'm not worried about that anymore, but how do you learn now as a teacher? And what we know is teachers are not going to classes or taking degrees because they're busy, they're working. They've got classes every day, and yet they still have the obligation to learn things. They have the obligation to learn new policies and procedures. They have the obligation to learn about new textbooks and new curricula. They have the obligation to learn about new pedagogy. So I ask them, how do you learn now? And the answer always comes back to me. They say, I learn from my colleagues. Right? I don't take courses, well, I'm forced to go to courses, but I learn from my colleagues. If I need to know something and I don't know it, I ask someone who knows. And it's so common sense, right? Ask someone who knows. And so I say, as you think about the things that would help you in your own learning, you will by yourself, you don't even need me, you will by yourself gradually acquire this understanding of networks-based pedagogy. Look at your own practice. Be reflective on it. Look at what you do each day to learn new things. That is the pedagogy that I am describing. And that's the funny thing about, you know, MOOCs and connectivism. They're not an invention. I'd love to take credit for having invented something. I really would. I'd get a prize. But they're not. They are designed on the actual practices of professionals who work in the field. In Alberta, we are developing something called MuniMall, an online learning resources and educational portal for the municipal sector in Alberta. It's elected town officials, town managers, and the rest. And so we surveyed them, and we asked them, how do you learn things? Because there are no courses on how to be a mayor. There just aren't. There should be, but no, I'm kidding. And what they say is, this was back in the late 1990s, what they said is, I pick up the phone and I call someone. And there's such a difference between that and I take a course. Because if I'm sitting here and I have a budget in front of me and I need to figure out a way of making these numbers work, I do not have time for a course. Right? So I call someone and I ask. Well, how do you know who to call? Well, I have a Rolodex of friends, of people I know and trust. Well, how do you know you trust them? Well, I've talked to them before. Right? So the structure of the MOOC and the structure of the personal learning environment is the same as the structure of the way people learn now when they are not in school. And that's how teachers can learn pedagogy using a MOOC. A MOOC is an organized way, using the internet and some of the neat tools, to call someone up and ask a question. That's all a MOOC is. Mm-hmm.
¿Alguna otra pregunta que quieran hacer? Por favor.
Laura?
Okay.
They need a microphone. Uh-huh. Otherwise, the translator won't be able to.
Okay. Me dicen si la traducción. Escuchan si no yo repito. Sí.
Very good.
Muchas personas dicen que tenemos un trabajo, opiniones, en donde se da un peso equivalente en el sector educativo a lo que fue el desarrollo del modelo de
formación. Espera, ya viene el micrófono. Sí, bueno, resumo, en muchas publicaciones se les ha dado a los MOOCs un papel o
en muchas publicaciones se le ha dado a los MOOCs el tamaño, digamos, el impacto en el sector educativo que en su momento tuvieron el formato de MP3 y Napster, por ejemplo, en el sector de la música. Me gustaría conocer la opinión de este señor.
Yeah. So, many publications compare the MOOCs oh, I don't need the Spanish translation of my own English. So many publications compare MOOCs with things like Napster and MP3s, and I think there's a validity to that comparison, but we need to understand why Napster happened and what happens to the music industry. Because it didn't just happen by magic, right? And there's two major things that I would identify. Number one, the format. The MP3 format was a type of file that could be played using any music player. So the content was accessible to anybody. Compare that to ebooks, for example, which are hard to share because they don't work half the time. Or your online courses, which are hard to share. The second thing is the tool to play the music. You know, Napster was just a file sharing tool, but people had MP3 players. And, oh, I guess I have a second prop. And they had a way of carrying their music around with them and listening to it anytime they wanted. And all of a sudden, interestingly, it became a lot more valuable and people were willing to make more of an effort to get it. They still weren't willing to pay $15 for 8 songs, but they were willing to buy one of each. Interesting. So we can learn some lessons from this. Openness really matters. And openness is what is going to change education, but the tools really matter as well.
Tenemos dos más. Moisés Antonio Santillán Briano, que es estudiante y obrero, pregunta: ¿la educación en línea es el futuro de la educación? La pregunta es si la educación en línea será el futuro de la educación.
Okay, so question from a student and a bricklayer, and the question is whether online education is the future of education per se, and the answer is yes. And you might think, well, I'm a bricklayer. Bricks are not digital objects, right? But people think of online learning as like a computer screen, right? But it's not. It's much more than that. Let's take, as an example, because it's handy, bricklayer education. And a person who is a bricklayer, maybe they went to a class, but many bricklayers that I know learned from, well, their father, who was also a bricklayer, or they learned on the job, because they came in with some carpentry skills and they picked up learning how to be a bricklayer. And that's hard, but you can do it. But it's hard to, you know, if you're on your own and you're trying to learn how to be a bricklayer, it's hard to know whether you're doing it well, whether you're making mistakes. You have to have that line across the top and your bricks have to be perfectly level and all of that. And so what will happen in things like bricklaying is you'll have a tool and you'll do your work, you'll lay some bricks, and then you'll use your tool, you'll take a picture of your bricks, and then the analytics in your tool will look at your bricks and give you criticism. And you might not want criticism, but that might be what the tool gets you. But the thing is, the tool will give you feedback. Am I doing it well? Am I doing it poorly? Did I use too much mortar? Did I use too little mortar? Was the mixture right? So there will be tools that feed back. Even better, as you become a better bricklayer, remember you're always taking pictures of your bricks. And your personal learning record keeps these pictures. Well, it stores them somewhere and it keeps a record of these pictures. After a while, you're a pretty good bricklayer because the tool has been helping you and you want a job. The way you apply for that job is you send the employer the evidence from your tool that, yes, I can do a pretty good bricklaying. and that qualifies you for the job. And it's that combination of feedback and connection to employment that will make online learning the main source of learning in the future. You still want someone to show you how to lay bricks, but the tool will help a lot.
Jesús Rodríguez, quien es maestro, pregunta, ¿cuál es el rol del maestro? ¿Solo diseñar?
No. The question is, you know, is the only role of the professor or the teacher to design? And clearly not. I read an article this morning, in fact, from Harvard Business Review. Harvard Business Review is very often wrong, but in this case they were right. And they were saying, interestingly, that with the increase in technology comes an increase in the need for social skills. And teaching is a social skill. So here's what changes. The teacher in the past, and largely in the present, was the sort of person who delivered content. Get to the front of the room and read a lecture. Something like that, right? That role is going to change. And all I can say is thank goodness, because teachers are really bad speakers. Many of them, not all of them. It's truth. The worst education classes I've ever had have been from professors of education. But what teachers are really good at, and the reason why they want to be teachers, is the social skills. Inspiring people, motivating people, posing challenges to people, giving an example to people, recognizing the greatness in people, and helping connect people with other people and with resources. These are all tasks that are really hard for computers to do now, and probably for the foreseeable future. Certainly for my lifetime. Probably for yours. Except for some of you there that are very young. And so we see the role of the teacher shifting, and in a very interesting way, shifting away from being someone who represents the institution and represents knowledge to someone who becomes an advocate and supporter of the student to help them navigate through knowledge, navigate through institutions, navigate through a career. We'll have other systems to evaluate and test. We'll have other systems to say, you've done wrong. The teacher will be the person who becomes the person who's on the student's side, helping them, encouraging them, pushing them forward. I think it's a more important role, personally. You know, I think that's always been the fundamental role of teachers, and we've misunderstood it over the years, you know, when we've had standardized testing and textbooks and centralized curricula. But the fundamental role of the teacher has always been that personal relation with the student and being a model of the knowledge, the values, and the practices that we want to see instantiated in our students. That does not go away.
¿Alguna otra pregunta que quieran hacer? No, también, bueno, aprovecharía para hacer una personalmente. Sí, algunos autores han interpretado que hablar de la personalización o de los ambientes personales es lo contrario a lo masivo, como si hubiera una tendencia a la personalización que alejara de la propuesta de masificación. Esto es así. Uh-huh. Incluso también esta contradicción aparente que ya en alguna pregunta se trató entre lo personal y lo colectivo, ¿no? Entonces, ¿realmente son contradictorios?
So, again, this is talking about the personalization of systems that have been developed and talked about in the literature. I want to draw a really important distinction for you. Fundamental distinction between personalization and personal. I don't know how that translates into Spanish, but you sort of see it. In English, we also have the distinction between customization and custom. Right? In the one, you take a big thing and you change some features to adapt to an individual. In the other, it's made specifically for the individual and very often at the direction of and under the control of the individual themselves. Now, if I was having a house built, I would rather have a custom house where I design it instead of a customized house which looks like everybody else's house but has a blue roof. And so that's the difference, right? A lot of the time when we talked about these massive large systems and personalized education, they are talking about a learning management system that will let you log in and maybe have your own list of friends and maybe even your own personal URL. That's customized. That's personalized. But there is a hard limit to what can be done by these systems, and that hard limit is set by the number of variables you can instantiate in the system. It's a quantificational limit. Personal, there is no such limit. Because personal, each individual learning environment is created from scratch. And it is a thing that is built specifically for that person and then interacts with other objects, other entities in the wider environment. So you don't need to build a big thing and then customize it. You build a little thing, which is just what the person needed. I don't know if that addressed the question, but that's the answer to the question.
Muchas gracias. No sé si alguien quiera comentar algo más, alguna otra pregunta. Bueno, hay muchas seguramente, pero... ¿No? De acuerdo. Bueno, si es así, cerraríamos con esto esta conferencia. Y bueno, yo quisiera reiterar que estos días han sido para nosotros de... un conocimiento no solo de estos fundamentos, no solo de las ideas, nos ha permitido vivenciar algo que fue muy importante en la experiencia, por ejemplo, del taller. Es esto en lo que ha insistido también hoy en su conferencia, de hay que vivir, hay que experimentarlo, ¿no? No es solo una cuestión, creo que él, su esfuerzo y su compromiso ha sido con hacer vivo aquello que piensa, no solo hablar de él, sino ejecutarlo, mostrarlo. Y creo que esa es la diferencia, ¿no? que hace con tal vez muchos otros autores que están en el mismo campo y de lo cual puedes aprender mucho. Es incluir, si me lo permite, fijen algunos elementos que también nos han permitido más conocer de su persona, como que le gustan, ama los gatos y le gustaron los tacos. Sí. Gracias, Stephen. Un aplauso.
Muchas gracias y thank you to the translator.
Claro. Sí, muchas gracias a todos por su asistencia, mucho luego por comentar y seguir discutiendo entre nosotros y, por supuesto, enlazados a. Así en su grupo, gracias otra vez para todos. Y con esto damos por terminada esta conferencia. Gracias.
Gracias.